It's kind of in my face.
That's the point of a microphone.
Okay. Get a little personal there, microphone.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. I'm a tad hoarse, but thanks for bearing with me. Election day was about 2 weeks ago, but we do have some new results to discuss. The tallies are in Georgia, Florida, and Arizona. The tallies are also in on whether 2018 did indeed turn out to be the year of the woman in the way that we've been discussing. We will discuss exactly what that means, but at least 123 women will serve in the next Congress, which is a record. And the bipartisan breakdown shows that women are actually losing ground, though, on the Republican side in the Republican caucus. Here to discuss it all, caught up on sleep, editor-in-chief Nate Silver, just barely.
Semi, but like, it's like when you start catching up on sleep, you actually get more tired because you like realize
your
how
deficit.
Stressful. And I do think that, like, to be sound very narcissistic,
good
even thought. Relative to podcast standards of narcissism, which are high, I do feel like my personal stress level is like actually a pretty good predictor of how high turnout would be. Whereas like this midterm, I would say it was like 75% of like presidential year stress level. And that's like basically what turnout was. So
just put it in the model.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know. Claire Malone, Politics Twitter. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Great. And here is managing editor Micah Cohen. Hello, Micah.
Hello.
Later in the show, Perry Bacon Jr. is going to join us to discuss the debate among Democrats over who should be the next Speaker of the House and moreover kind of Nancy Pelosi's role in the 2018 Democratic caucus. But let's begin with the ongoing results from the midterm. Florida is now settled. Bill Nelson and Andrew Gillum have conceded to Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott in the Senate and governor's races. That's a victory on both sides for Republicans. In Georgia, Democratic Stacey Abrams gave a sort of non-concession speech to Brian Kemp. She acknowledged that he will be the next governor of Georgia, but raised a bunch of questions about the process of the election itself. And in Arizona, Republican Martha McSally conceded the Senate race to Democrat Kyrsten Sinema. Let's talk Georgia first. Anyone want to characterize Stacey Abrams' non-concession and give us a sense of what you made of it?
She seemed to be, if I can sort of not put so much weight on the word concession for a second, she seemed to be conceding the race but not the issue. You know, she was saying that Brian Kemp will be the next governor of Georgia, but that she was not conceding that the way he got there was fair. Her speech was actually really interesting in that she herself said this, that it was not your normal concession speech where you say, you know, this is when we come together and blah, blah, blah. She was very clear that in her view, and, you know, most of the facts back her up, Kemp had a long and willful effort to try to make it hard for some Georgians to vote, and that had an effect. So she didn't make any bones about that.
When you say the facts back her up, how do we go about trying to assess exactly, is it even possible to assess exactly what Brian Kemp's policies, the impact they had on the actual vote?
I think it's very hard, and I think it would take a kind of thoughtful analysis that there hasn't been time for yet. I mean, to take one small example, right? Both anecdotally and there's some data to suggest that there were really long lines in more Democratic-leaning areas. So how do you account for people just like, you know, if you're waiting 3.5 hours to vote, a lot of people will just get out of line and leave after an hour. That's a hard thing to measure. You know, maybe it's a little easier to look at the effect of like voting roll purges, but still, there's two separate questions here. It's like, one, was there an effort to suppress the vote? I think the answer to that is yes. Two, did it have a meaningful effect on the actual result? That's harder. Yeah, I don't think we know the answer to that or likely ever will.
And I think some of this is very much strategic on the part of Abrams, who I believe in her concession speech said, this isn't over, we're starting this voting rights group. But also just the last like week of that election was truly nuts, I think. I mean, when Kemp suggested that the Democratic Party of Georgia had hacked the state systems with no evidence.
This is the last week prior to the vote, right?
Correct, yes. That was so irresponsible that I think there are lots of really bad feelings, understandably, from the Abrams campaign side. So I think the fact that this race ended on a sour note is not a surprise.
And Nate, do you feel like Abrams is walking what is a pretty fine line in the way that Micah described here of trying to highlight some issues, but also not come off as bitter or breaking a norm about the way that candidates are supposed to concede? I mean, is it going to work in some way in terms of getting us to talk about this stuff?
I mean, look, I think when Republicans and Democrats imply or say that the election was stolen, they kind of mean two different things that are not quite equivalent. When Trump was alleging that there were shenanigans in the Florida recount, he was saying that Democrats were kind of cheating or forging, I believe, the way ballots were counted, and that like kind of illegal means were being used to manipulate the outcome. I think the
or wearing different hats, going in their car,
or wearing different hats, right? That fraud was occurring. I think the allegation that Democrats are making is that Republicans are working within the law,
yeah,
or at least at the outer boundaries of the law to suppress Democratic votes and African American votes. And so those are two different types of allegations. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure that either one should use terminology like stolen necessarily, but I think there's like, I think that gives, frankly, centrist pundits and centrist kind of reporters an excuse to both sides an issue that's really complicated and where it isn't equivalent. I mean, the fact is that Republicans generally try to make voting harder and Democrats generally try to make it easier. And generally speaking, when turnout is higher, I mean, all these states where you have provisional ballots being counted, right? Not in every state. There's like actually an exception in Utah, it looks like. But like in most states, those marginal voters who have the most difficult time voting tend to be Democrats. And the people who come to the polls at the last minute and vote tend to be Democrats and so on and so forth. And so like this is pretty obvious and the stakes are pretty high and Democrats are becoming more aware of it. And Georgia had this weird, almost perfect storm where the Republican candidate is the Secretary of State. Georgia is a state where I think anyone would say that of the states that have more things going on, that this is one of the states that there's been more effort to like to make it harder to vote. And you have a margin where, you know, mere tenths of a point above the recount threshold and the overall margin is, what, 1 or 1.5 points or something like that. And so it's a case where this stuff could conceivably matter. And I remember kind of looking at, I mean, this is right in line with the polls, this outcome, right? I remember kind of looking at like Abrams Kemp and being like, okay, Kemp is about a point or a point and a half ahead in the polling average. And it was pretty consistent. And boy, this is the kind of race where this actually could matter because Georgia is a state where not a ton of swing voters. It's about, can you turn out that vote? Are there enough Democrats to 50% where the Democrats are mostly black in Georgia or they're mostly college students or people who are newly moved to Georgia, all people that can have more problems with their registration status.
It's also interesting to see some of the stuff that Cindy Hyde-Smith is saying in Mississippi. She is in a runoff election with Mike Espy, a Democrat, and she's made some off-the-cuff, supposedly joking questions, but very pointed jokes about, well, we should really try to depress student turnout. She's made just some interesting sort of like joking stuff about voter, I don't know if I'm going to call it voter suppression, but it's certainly
voter suppression.
It certainly tilts that way. So it's interesting to see in these southern states, which we should talk about. There are certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act that a couple years ago were, you know, rolled back, right? So that the certain counties and places where if there were changes around voting laws, you had to run it by someone in the federal government, and those are places in the South, in a lot of instances where there's this is just a bit more of like an open thing in these traditionally, I guess, conservative controlled places.
The other thing I would just highlight is, you know, Nate bringing up kind of what the right way to for Democrats to talk about these voter suppression efforts. It's a problem for them because, one, I do have this worry. It does tend to get lumped in with other efforts to undermine the vote, even though it's sort of categorically different. And it does sort of make you think, oh, my God, are people going to lose faith in these elections? But it is categorically different. I was surprised. There was this Sherrod Brown quote. You know, he didn't make any. He was like, quote, if Stacey Abrams doesn't win in Georgia, they stole it. It's clear. I say that publicly. That's pretty strong language and I think reflects the fact that the effort in Georgia, it was sort of a perfect storm of conditions, as Nate said, but it also, I think it's fair to say, those efforts went further and were more blatant.
Because he was in a position of power to do so, specifically as Secretary of State, administering that state's election in which he was a candidate.
And, you know,
it is slightly a slightly absurdly specific way to use your power.
Abrams actually had this line in her non-concession concession speech where she said, stoicism is a luxury. I think she's right that, like, it's all well and good. See, I think Nate saying, oh, this gives an excuse for centrist journalists and commentators to both sides it, I think that lets them off the hook. Like,
it's too easy on the. Well, no, I mean, the speech was complex and, like, it required holding more than one thought in your head at once. In the spirit of that, in the spirit of adding another thought in your head, the evidence for how much this matters in terms of the impact on the results is, I think, pretty ambiguous and uncertain. There is not, like, a comprehensive, that I'm aware of, an authoritative study, maybe there couldn't be, that says, oh, this cost Democrats 2 points in Georgia, therefore she would have won. I don't know, maybe we should do that. Maybe we should do that or partner with another news organization or something and make an effort to put some outer bounds on this. You know, I think in general, when people have tried to study it, they have found that it affects fewer people than you would think, and also that people compensate by being more diligent in trying to figure out how to vote. You know, but there are also things that kind of fade into the background. So the fact that former felons couldn't vote in Florida, so 20% of the African-American population in Florida is disenfranchised, I mean, that has just been baked into the background conditions in Florida. And so when we think of Florida as being a state that's, you know, 2 points Republican-leaning relative to the national average, that's part of the reason why. And now Florida, ironically enough, has passed an amendment to restore voting rights to ex-felons, and that might shift things by half a point or a point maybe. People tried to measure this. Ironically enough, if that had been passed beforehand, then probably both Gillum and Billy Nelson...
Good old
His
Billy
concession
Nelson.
Was weird, by the way.
Oh, I didn't watch that. What did
he just seems like kind of a space cadet, literally.
Literally.
But both certainly Nelson, given how close it was, and Gillum would probably have won. And so, you know.
I can't believe we're hating on an astronaut. It just seems wrong.
Yeah. It's un-American to hate on an astronaut.
Well, but it's just like, you know, part of it, too, is like kind of if you're analyzing the implications for what works in politics, what doesn't, who's popular, who, you know, to some extent, it's an indication that whenever an election is within like 2 points or something, that you should kind of consider it a tie, roughly speaking, you know, because it's sometimes hard to know if everyone in the state who had an intention to vote would have voted, how different would those results have been.
So is it the case, Micah, that in this election there were a couple high profile examples of, you know, the wheels of democracy not working very well and it popped up and we're all talking about it? Or is it kind of like, that's always the case, and we just happen to finally come around now to have the capacity and the attention to, like, stop and point and discuss it?
I'd probably say a little of both. I think it's always the case, as we said in Georgia, there were a couple more blatant examples this year. But I think it's always the case that our electoral system is dispersed and messy and volunteer-driven and blah, blah, blah.
And discriminatory. I mean, going back to it, the Voting Rights Act, like, it has been, this is nothing new in American history. I think what's different is public officials and the way they no longer dog whistle, almost. Like, they're more, in the Kemp election, like, the fact of, without evidence, saying that the Democrats hacked the system, you know, saying to donors, we'd better hope that these people don't turn out to vote. He said that a few days before the election. It just felt a little more on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think so this, like, trend we've seen exemplified by Trump of subtext becoming text. And then also, we've also seen a long-term trend, I think, of more focus on these issues. Even before this election, you know, I think people have become more focused on efforts to suppress the vote, problems in the voting system. I mean, 2016 was an example of that. And so both those combined, I think we're going to be talking about this well into 2020.
And Abrams did do a lot of work, you know, just to point out, maybe Sherrod Brown didn't do it, but Abrams did do a lot of work to say, this isn't just about the election I just lost, this is about future elections, and really trying to cast it forward and add that larger context. So,
well, Democrats are in much firmer ground, I think, if they can decouple this issue from specific elections, because there is a tendency for Americans and for, like, centrist journalists to want to be like, don't be a sore loser, even if you're a sore loser over legitimate issues. So,
and as you said, Abrams kind of called that out in advance and almost took away that storyline where she was like, you know, centrist pundits are going to want to give me a hard time for not mollifying here. But yeah, I don't know. Does anyone want to add any quick thoughts on Florida or cinema taking Arizona, or do we want to move on?
The Arizona win was really good for Democrats. The Florida loss is really bad for Democrats. That's
okay. That was
exciting.
17
Wait,
seconds.
Here's a question I actually don't know the answer to. Nate, are the Florida results an outlier or not?
I don't know what you mean by outlier. I mean, there are a lot of races where, so if you do like a little regression where you look at the state's partisanship and whether there was an incumbent or not, you know, that's one of the ones more on the outer edge, although by that standard, like Joe Manchin winning in West Virginia also shows up as an outlier, for example, or Klobuchar winning by so much in Minnesota, or Menendez winning by so little, though it was double digits in New Jersey, right? And so, you know, it wasn't that weird. I mean, clearly, I think you had a Republican candidate who was, in a literal sense, sort of an incumbent himself, who raised a lot of his, spent a lot of his own money. It's not clear to me if he actually spent more, because Nelson had a lot of money, too. But, you know, I mean, that you know, that was, like, not a great result for Democrats, for sure.
But not crazy. Because part of my question is, I think I saw some quote from, I think, like, a Florida political operative who was like, you know, there was this national blue wave, but it didn't come to Florida. And my question was sort of like, well, is that right? Or did it just so happen to be, you know, half a percentage point on the wrong side of the margin for Democrats?
If you add up the House vote in Florida, and you have to adjust for the fact that Florida doesn't count votes in uncontested races, so there are between 500,000 and 1 million votes that weren't counted in that tally for Democrats. If you add those in, the Democrats won the popular vote for the House in Florida by like 3 or 4 points, which is like kind of fairly normal. And so I think you had an above average candidate in Scott and a below average one in Nelson. The governor's race is a little bit more perplexing. I mean, you know, it is, has been difficult to get African-American candidates elected in the South. And I think, I don't know if there's like a mini little tiny, teeny tiny Bradley effect. Maybe not. You know, that race seemed to be tightening a little bit at the end, but probably be interested in reading like a post-mortem of the Gillum campaign and how it didn't quite come together at the end there. Scott, by the way, did fairly well with Hispanic voters, and that was pretty important. But yeah, look, Florida was certainly one of the most disappointing states for Democrats, yeah.
Okay, let's move on, and we're going to talk about, as I mentioned, there are more women in the next Congress than ever before, and we're going to talk about why that is and the sort of makeup of that caucus. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by GiveWell. It is the end of the year. It is time to think about your charitable contributions. A lot of people like to give at this time of year, but many people who want to give to good charities don't know how to maximize the good that they can accomplish for each dollar that you give. Well, GiveWell does an in-depth, detailed research to identify evidence-backed, cost-effective programs helping the poorest people in the world. At GiveWell.org, you can see a very short list of top charities that have met GiveWell's exacting standards. GiveWell is unique because it focuses on how much good a charity accomplishes. For example, how many lives does it save, or how much does someone's income increase with each dollar donated? Instead of focusing on easier to answer but less important questions like how much a charity's CEO makes or how much overhead it has, which are factors that go into other ratings for charities. Its current top charities do things like fund programs to prevent child deaths from malaria or provide direct cash transfers to very poor households in East Africa. All of the details of GiveWell's work are available for free on its website. GiveWell deeply vets scientific evidence for programs. Its charity reviews are accompanied by hundreds of footnotes. We know the 538 crowd loves footnotes. And it publishes its quantitative cost-effectiveness models, so you can dive in into all the details if you're interested. Make sure that your charity dollars are doing the most work they can. Go to GiveWell.org right now. Once again, that's givewell.org. All right, we're back. And now that the votes have been counted, for the most part, it looks like 2018 will be indeed the year of the woman. At least 123 women will be in the next Congress, and at least 113 of those women were elected this year. There are 10 female senators who were not up for election. This breaks previous records overall, but it's almost entirely on the Democratic side. Republicans will actually have fewer women in Congress than in years past. So does everyone agree? You can nod or you vocalize. This ended up being the year of the woman. Is that a fair thing to say? And then we'll get into what exactly that means.
I was actually going to say, I think that the men on this podcast, so there are three men in this room and one woman.
Correct.
And I am curious to hear the men in this room's take on, I don't like nicknames for stuff that happens, but I'm curious to hear what you guys think having this many more women in Congress will actually do. And you can base it off of our experience with Congress, our experience as when more women come into a workplace. We could even use this one as an example. What do you guys think the effect will be?
I think that this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I don't mean it as a cop-out. It will make Congress less reflexively dismissive of issues that aren't in the narrow interests of white men. That's what I think. Look at like the Me Too movement, and all of a sudden we learned that Congress was like paying out these like secret payouts.
So culture change.
Yeah, I think it'll have a, you know, help subtly shift the culture. I don't think it'll be like a night and day, you know.
I have an instinct, which I can't prove or anything. I mean, my instinct is that it might make Democrats a bit more willing to take risks, a bit more progressive, you know, a bit less subscribed to like the conventional wisdom about how you're supposed to behave in Washington. I don't know. I don't know why I think that necessarily. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, a lot of members of Congress are like are people that are kind of from the establishment and they have like a lot of privilege. I don't love that term, but like it's probably a good term if you meet a member of Congress, right? They usually probably went to Harvard or Yale and, you know, were a very successful lawyer and have a lot of money and whatever else, right? And so I think when you have people who are a more diverse and appropriate and kind of better representatives of their communities, then I think you maybe have people who don't subscribe to the conventional wisdom quite as much. And gender is like not a perfect proxy for that, but I think it has something to do with it. And also the fact that the new class is more racially diverse. It's also kind of a class that brings in a lot of non-politicians.
Yeah.
When we looked at the we have a variable model, how many people have previously held elected office? That was not especially high for Democrats. And yet they did very well because they brought in people who were had a military background or a business background or a community organizing background or whatever else, right? And I think that will lead to more healthier discussions within the Democratic caucus.
Yeah, I think someone like Lucy McBath, who won that Georgia 6th, much talked about Georgia 6th race and was a Democrat, is obviously a woman. She's a black woman. She ran in part because she lost her son because he died because of a gun death. I think you can kind of separate out the kind of people who are maybe motivated, women who ran and were motivated by Trump. I think a lot of them would say that. And there's the, what is it, the service candidates. I guess, you know, it's a different kind of woman running for office. It's
what does service candidate mean?
So it means someone who either served in the armed forces or in, let's say, the CIA or the FBI, one of those kind of government jobs. And those women, a lot of those women were running in like red swingy places. And I think it was an interesting way of running as a woman where it's kind of like, I'm a strong woman. And then there were women who were running on, you know, this more like progressive outsider. I'm a woman and I'm an outsider and I have different experiences and this is why I should be elected. So there are, it's an interesting cohort that's coming into Congress. They're certainly all women, but I think a lot of them have come into office in different ways with different narratives.
So Mike, if we look at the number of women in Congress now, can we connect that not just in a cultural change within the halls of Congress, but can we connect that to actually to actual new policy shifts that we might see?
I was looking at the Center for American Women in Politics, which is part of Rutgers, and we've worked with COP. Yeah,
COP.
We've worked with them a little bit. They, first of all, if anyone's interested, they have like a ton of just really great research on this, but also like overviews of that research. And anyway, there's all types of good stuff. Generally, what they found is that women are to the left of men. I think Nate said that as a hunch. You know, they have one study here that has shown that. They also did this really interesting survey of women already in office and asked them how they think having more women in office is different. And they found, so I'll just read this out loud, a majority of the women we interviewed believe that women are more likely than their male counterparts to walk across party lines. Large numbers of congresswomen express the belief that women are more consensual and collaborative than their male colleagues. And in interview after interview, in different ways, using different words, they explain that women are more results-oriented, more likely to emphasize achievement over ego, and more concerned with achieving policy outcomes rather than receiving publicity or credit. So I don't know if you buy that. It sort of plays heavily into – sorry. Yeah.
It plays into a stereotype. I always think this is sort of interesting where – so let's just take like a politician who's a woman who's been in office for a while and a politician who's a man who's been in office for a while. To me, there's this interesting thing where like I do have this a little bit of this bio where like all politicians, especially on the national level, are a bit of egotists, right? Like,
yeah.
But there is this thing that as a woman politician, and I think it's a pretty convincing thing, given that like a lot of women's magazines, I'm thinking of you, Real Simple, spend their entire time with like these all these columns devoted to like how do you make everyone's life around you easier, right? So there is a little bit of this idea of women as societal martyrs. But it is interesting when you go into politics and like I find it in some ways a bit reductive to say that women don't have egos. But I understand what these women are saying because, frankly, it's politically advantageous to say as a woman I'm a more collaborative thinker. I'm more of a doer. I'm more, but it's a certain kind of ego itself. Anyway, but that's interesting.
No, but that point is really important. So this other COP study found that the issues where there were the greatest gender differences in terms of what issues you rate as a priority were women's rights, healthcare, children, families, which plays right into, I think, stereotypes about women. But Claire is totally right that, like, how much of that is elected women care about different things than elected men, or how much of it is self-selection? So in other words...
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be clear, I do think that women candidates probably do care about slightly different issues. Like, I think they care about the core issues that any politician probably has to answer to with their constituents, namely the economy, right? Like, that's just whatever.
A
you
given.
Know, like, yeah. And frankly, in this environment, like, you're going to have a stance on immigration or something like that. But I do think that women do typically have different life experiences. And so you might place, you know, it's not that a male liberal politician wouldn't have really progressive policies on childcare or maternal leave, whatever it might be, parental leave in general, but they might not prioritize it as much because perhaps it wasn't a life experience that they had, and therefore they feel in their gut that things are deeper. So I'm not trying to say that women candidates aren't going to focus on different things and bring different perspectives, but I do think that the interesting narratives that enter when we start talking about it's the year of the woman and, like, we're all going to be more collaborative. To me, I'm kind of like, well, we're all coming into this as in a system that, you know, in order to get reelected 2 years from now, you do have to make certain self-interested decisions, certain decisions to please a donor class. Like, I do think that there will be probably cultural changes, but I also think that Congress is an institution that has norms that are pervasive regardless of what gender you are. And by the way, I think I don't know if we're going to talk about Nancy Pelosi's thing later, but Nancy Pelosi is using her gender in an extremely savvy way,
yeah,
in a way that I think is worthy of a politician, perhaps a politician with a big ego.
You know, I think this is what you're saying, Claire, before, but tell me if you're wrong, but I think it's right, even if you weren't saying it. So let's say that women elected officials are more likely than male elected officials to prioritize, like, health care and issues around children, let's say, right? How much of that is because women in general, as you were saying, due to, you know, lived experiences, prioritize those issues? And how much of it is that voters expect women to prioritize those issues? So in other words, some of what we're seeing could be genuine differences in what elected officials prioritize, but it also could reflect sort of baked in expectations from voters about traditional gender roles. And, like, if you're a woman running in a race, there's some incentive to play into, hey, I care about healthcare. There's also some incentive to play against.
Well,
those
I think
stereotypes.
It's, honestly, I think some of it depends on party, right?
Yeah.
If you're a Republican woman, in some ways you're running against type, right? Being a woman is a bit more of a liability given given the demographics of, you know, let's say a Republican primary base or a Republican voter. So I think as a Republican woman, and there are fewer of them, which I don't know if we've mentioned this, but most of the women
there are barely any in Congress.
Yeah, most of the women who were elected to Congress this year were Democratic. And so I do think it depends on what party you're running in, but yeah, I mean, I would say if you're a Democrat and, like, the big issues are childcare, healthcare, I think you do also realize that you want to turn out a certain kind of woman voter, perhaps one that identifies with you and is excited about you because you look like them and you talk about things that they've experienced, whereas, you know, the guy who ran before, let's say, shared the same political views but wasn't as compelling because he looked like you and had the same experiences. I think that can't be underrated, but I do think it varies by party.
Let me ask one last question on this, going back to some of the narratives that you were describing. You know, we were talking about that narrative that women are more likely to reach across the aisle and be conciliatory and look for bipartisanship. There's this other narrative out there that I think is backed up in some sense by the stats as well, that women are powering the resistance to Trump and the pushback against Trump as a women-led movement. So how do those two square for these new women arriving in Congress who have this sort of mass anti-Trump push behind them, but then maybe this expectation that they will be more bipartisan leaning?
Yeah, I mean, I guess our much-cited research, the only kind of, like, political science research that we have right now on the indivisible groups, which are the proxy for the hashtag resistance. It's by Theda Skocpol and her research partner, and it basically says, you know, a lot of these local indivisible groups are run by middle-aged, college-educated white ladies. That they kind of call them like the librarian resistance kind of thing. And I think that that's interesting.
Yeah. No,
And shows up in the midterm election results.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It oversimplifies things a little, but just a little, to say that women are powering the resistance against Trump. I think in large measure they are, both in an activist sense, as that research Claire mentioned gets at, but also if you just look at the 2018 results, take white women. Trump won white women by 12 points in 2016. The two parties were tied between them, according to the exit polls this year. That's a big jump, and I if only men voted, then Republicans would still control the House.
And to me, it's so interesting. I mean, I do think we've talked about a lot that suburban college-educated white women were the people who were kind of the star demographic in some ways. And yeah, I mean, I think in some ways you can only chalk it up to the existence of Trump. And you saw in men and women's reactions to the Kavanaugh hearings, just the dramatically gendered way that people interpreted results. And I think for a lot of women, it's just, in some ways, it's a perfect storm of Trump being elected, and then there was the Me Too movement, and a lot of things that I think have bugged women about gender dynamics in the workplace, gender dynamics with their partners even, where you kind of, I think a lot of women finally felt like, listen, we're talking about this. This guy's a jerk, fill in the blank guy, whatever, politician, powerful executive who's taken down by Me Too. And I do think it's a bit of this perfect storm that Republicans have to figure out electorally going forward, because the fact that there are so few Republican women who won in the quote-unquote year of the woman, I mean...
No, it's a problem.
It's a problem. And I don't think, you know, this is not a... this is just numbers. Like, the Republican Party, I think, has a long-term problem. I mean, we talk a lot about the electoral college advantage that they have right now, the advantage in the Senate in these, you know, smaller rural states. But you can't alienate half of the population and be a long-term successful party.
No, and this gets at, you know, what we were saying about women elected officials. Political scientists have also found this true of women voters, which is to say, again, these studies have found place more of an emphasis on social welfare issues, so like healthcare, childcare, et cetera. And men place more of an emphasis on issues like taxes and national security. The Democratic Party has better ratings on issues like healthcare and childcare, and the Republican Party has better ratings on issues, you know, generally speaking, like taxes and national security. And so I think Trump has presented the GOP with an acute problem regarding women, but there's this more cultural longstanding problem.
Because one last little thing, which is like the Republicans could easily tie, like in the future, figure out ways to tie those like economic issues that people identify with them to healthcare or childcare or economic opportunity
for tax credit.
Economic opportunity for women. But I think they have a culture problem that preceded Trump, frankly. I mean, legitimate rape with Todd Akin in 2012, where they culturally alienate women. Because I would be remiss in saying on this podcast, as the only woman, that women only vote on reproductive issues or childcare issues. That flattens us as a gender and as thinking people, and that we don't always agree with other women. But I do think that the Republicans have to figure out a way that they can talk to women in their own authentic voice. And I don't think that they have found that.
All right. We're going to leave it there. We're going to move on, and we're going to talk about, as Claire said, this is slightly related, the upcoming election for Speaker of the House, and we're going to bring in our colleague Perry Bacon Jr. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. When WeWork was founded in 2010, the primary focus was to provide freelancers and entrepreneurs with an environment that allowed them to engage with and benefit from a network of like-minded businesses, all in a setting that encouraged innovation and collaboration. Well, WeWork now provides a range of solutions for medium, large, and enterprise businesses as well, such as private office space for up to 200 people and full floor custom buildouts. These include enhanced security, privacy, and the ability to express your brand identity while at the same time maintaining the innovative design, flexibility, and the high level of service that companies have come to expect from WeWork. From innovation labs to trading floors, regional headquarters to global campuses, WeWork is designing, building, and operating environments that empower your people to do their best work. Go to WeWork.com right now to find a location near you and learn more about office space products that you can take advantage of. Once again, that's WeWork.com. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Finn. Have you ever looked at your calendar first thing in the morning? This podcast comes out towards the beginning of the week, so maybe you're looking at your calendar for the whole week, and you have this feeling, there is no way I can get all of this done. Well, that's why Finn is there to help you out as a personal assistant. You don't need to spend your time recruiting, training, and managing an assistant. Finn can do it all. Finn can schedule meetings with coworkers or clients, answer calls, handle travel plans for your business trips, find and book service providers to fix things around the office. Finn does everything a great assistant can without the cost and commitment of a full-time hire. You only pay for what you use. Finn is available 24/7, 365 days a year, never calling in sick like I am today, or taking time off like I'm not today. Finn can save you 10 or more hours a week and help you be more productive so that you can grow your business. And right now, all of you can try Finn for free. Just go to finn.com/politics. That's finn.com/politics to try it for free. Again, you may not think of yourself as I need an assistant person, but this will be the difference. Go to finn.com/politics. All right, we're back now. Of course, Democrats won a majority in the House, so now they have to decide who is going to lead them. Nancy Pelosi, the current Democratic leader in the House, has faced challenges in the past, and there is once again talk about whether she will face serious opposition. In some ways, this is a debate, the ongoing debate about the identity of the party, but it is also very much a debate about Nancy Pelosi herself. Here to discuss it, along with our usual group, is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hello, Perry. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me, guys.
So what is the current state of the race? Is anyone serious running against Pelosi?
So far, there's a lot of opposition, but no one is actually running against her, so it's hard to imagine her losing. Well, I guess I shouldn't say it that way. In reality, if you talk to the people who are sort of running this anti-Pelosi campaign, what they want to do, if you remember, John Boehner got pushed out of being speaker in 2015, and Paul Ryan replaced him. Paul Ryan was never going to run against John Boehner. They were friendly. Paul Ryan didn't really want the job that badly. So what these guys really want to do is convince Pelosi that she will never get the votes and then have her say, I will not run for speaker. And they think there will be a Paul Ryan-like figure who wants to be speaker but doesn't want to run against Pelosi who will emerge if she sort of stands down. That's what you're seeing here is I don't think you're going to see a candidate really stand up until she stands down, and she probably isn't.
Is that still all theoretical, or are there some actual names of who that Paul Ryan figure might be?
That's all theoretical in part because if that person said, I am open to it, the Pelosi people would ask, you know, are you actually for this? There's a reason to stay silent if you want this job to become you down the line.
Anyone here in the room want to jump in? Is this a legit threat to Pelosi's speakership?
Yes.
Okay.
Nate?
I'm just deferring to the reporting. I mean, The reporting seems like there was more of a threat last week, and now it's kind of at stalemate's not the right term, right? There's not a clear alternative that's emerged to Pelosi.
But to Perry's point, there almost wouldn't be a clear alternative yet. We're not at that stage yet. Or am I butchering what you're saying, Perry?
I mean, look, it would obviously be better if there was some youngish, female, charismatic figure who was like the number three in the Democratic Party who it was obvious should replace Pelosi. That would be the ideal scenario. But in reality, the two people under her are Steny Hoyer and James Clyburn, who are older and probably would be worse at the job than her. So if I was going to give a name, I might say like if Adam Schiff was, you know, the Speaker of the House in March, I don't think Democrats would be mad about that. I think a lot of them would be much happier if he was a Speaker in March. But I don't think he's going to run against Pelosi and there's going to have to be a lot of, you know, behind the scenes machinations for that to happen.
I should have sort of laid these facts out on the table at the beginning, but the vote for leadership is on the 28th of November. That's within the Democratic caucus, and then it goes to a floor vote on January 3rd. She can afford to have maybe around 15 people vote against her, and there's maybe a group of 20 that people are watching as who said that they might oppose her. We don't have to go bit by bit, but Claire, is there a way to kind of characterize who the Pelosi skeptics or opposition are?
I mean, I think a lot of them fall under those who ran. Like, I think Connor Lamb is sort of like your prototypical, I'm not going to vote for Pelosi Democrat. So someone who won in Pennsylvania in a certain kind of like, let's call it like, you know, Joe Biden's constituency, you know, working class white people, whatever it might be. And then you've got someone like Abigail Spanberger in Virginia, who is, you know, one of the service candidates that I was talking about, a woman who's running as kind of like a, I don't know, for lack of a better characterization, like I'm a tough woman. I'm not just going to vote for Pelosi because she says I should, and I'm a Democrat. So I think it's a group that is generally younger. I think that is pretty easily agreed on, and they feel like they have to answer to how they ran, which was generally anti-Pelosi. And I don't know, it's an interesting group. I mean, the Washington Post had this thing about Seth Moulton's, I don't know how to, the article certainly shaded it as kind of like Seth Moulton's ego trip to get people to run against Pelosi. Like, there's a lot of, I think Mike DeBonis wrote this article and people should look it up. It's sort of an interesting background on how Moulton ran against a, you know, Pelosi ally and defeated him. And it's just, you know, sort of the interesting behind the scenes of the people who are sort of the most high profile anti-Pelosi-ers. But I don't know. That's, I would generally say younger Democrats.
Younger Democrats, but also more conservative Democrats, which I think is part of, yeah. I mean,
although you do have, I will say, sorry to jump in here, Micah, you do have people on the more liberal end who, like, let's say, Ocasio-Cortez, who
yes.
is coming out from a different direction.
No, there is some ideological diversity in the anti-Pelosi contingent, but I do think that a big chunk of it comes from the more conservative side of the caucus, mm-hmm. which presents a lot of problems for if your goal is to oust Pelosi. Like when the Freedom Caucus was trying to get rid of Boehner, yeah, they were at the right edge of the GOP caucus. But they also were at the edge that, like, where all the energy was and where kind of where the party was moving, while the Connor Lambs of the world are not that for the Democratic Party. But I don't know, Perry, does that seem right?
Yeah, there's like, right, there's a younger factor here. There's also like a few people, I think Linda Sanchez is from California, Marcia Fudge is from Ohio. They're pretty liberal people. I think Fudge is for impeachment even. But there's a group of Democrats who are established in the Congress who just sort of feel like the same three people have been in charge for almost, yeah. you know, more than 10 years, Clyburn, Hoyer, and Pelosi, and there should be some change. I mean, I think the point they're making, and I think it's correct one, is who else in America has been in charge of the same organization since 2005, right. particularly since Nancy Pelosi's record in 2018 was great. But up to then, while she's been in charge, it's not been like the greatest boom times for House Democrats. But the problem, of course, is they're trying to oust her now, as opposed to in 2016 when they had a really pretty strong case for that.
I just want to draw a circle around that kind of really interesting point, which is, I think, Micah, what you were saying is everyone's looking for a sort of to put this narrative of dissent within the Democratic Party, and they're trying to glom it onto this, but this may actually not be the best place on which to glom that narrative because there is that diversity.
The problem here is that the anti-Pelosi case is it's just messy and somewhat yeah. self-contradictory, where I think it's mostly about what Perry just said, which is like logistical, and you want to groom someone to take this over eventually, and they're not doing that.
They're all in their 70s, we should say, the top three.
Yeah, yeah, like upper 70s, and it yeah. like just feels
well,
stale.
Well, she's smart enough to pick rivals, not rivals, right, but second-in-commands who are not very f***ing appealing, and like that's what a lot of it's a power move. It's what a lot of bosses do, right? They'll pick.
Wait a second.
Says my managing editor, my income.
Wait a second here.
Oh, no.
Oh boy!
But look, we've turned to Pelosi herself, and I think that's the most interesting thing here. Is let's talk about that. So Nate, pick that back up. I mean, how do you view Pelosi right now as a leader of the party? Is she acquitting herself well, not just in this power struggle, but in sort of what comes next over the next 2 years?
You know, Democrats have lost a lot of elections since she's been the speaker. They passed a fair amount in the 2 years where they controlled everything from 2008 and 2010, and it's been the only time they controlled everything. So I don't know. I think she's been effective at keeping power. I think she's demonized sometimes for like unfair reasons, but I don't know why she has any like divine right to the speakership, and I don't know why you wouldn't want some generational turnover.
Yeah,
it's a very fair. I mean, I think what is so difficult for Democrats is we had a previous segment about the year of the woman, quote unquote. See my derisive air quotes, but not for electing women to Congress, but just like,
Claire. Jeez.
No, it's like how I hate calling states by their nicknames. You know this. I just hate nicknaming things. Anyway, I think that Democrats face this thing where they're saying, listen, we've elected more women to Congress than ever. Again, I said earlier, Nancy Pelosi has savvily weaponized the gender element of this, but there remains the very clear distinction of you need to train up younger leadership. And she has thrown some bones to younger people in the party, given them smaller jobs, although she hasn't put anyone young in the top tier of leadership. And I think this is, I mean, I have an overarching theory of like baby boomer culture being too prevalent in 2018 America. don't at me, older listeners. But I think that the Democrats find themselves in a really sticky situation. And I will say, to Nate's point, yeah, they had a more natural 2016 reason to do it, whereas in 2018, it kind of looks like a little bit of... It kind of looks mutinous. So I think that's the other thing. It's like, would it look good for the Democrats to oust Nancy Pelosi? Like, would that create an even different Pelosi problem for the Democrats, where Republicans say, like, well, they can't even decide what they want to do. Like, they can't, you know...
I don't think voters give a shit about that. Right.
But you don't think the narrative they're coming off a wave election and they can't even have their house in order, you don't think that's powerful?
No.
Huh?
I don't think voters care who the Speaker of the House is.
Nancy Pelosi?
They're not following the Speaker election. That's just like not something that has wide interest.
I mean, it would lead to a stupid media narrative that would not affect a single actual vote.
But we're not talking about votes for the next 2 years. We're talking about
the other thing about Pelosi is,
you don't think Trump would seize that narrative? You don't think Republicans would
seize
that
narrative? And do
what with it? And who the hell cares?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Seize it.
Yeah, you win a narrative, you know, yeah. Axios.
Wait, but before...
You won Axios, the state of Axios.
Before we move on from the Democratic bench, Perry, there is some young talent in the, like, okay, not that top tier of Democratic leadership, the, like, 2 and 3 positions, but a bit below that, right?
Yeah, like, if I were in charge, I mean, I think part of the issue here is that up to now, the top three leaders, Hoyer's basically the voice of the center Democrats, Pelosi, the liberal Democrats, Clyburn, the black Democrats. So that's why they have this arrangement they have, these people holding on, because they have their sort of voice to reach each faction. That said, at this point, there's a woman named Sherry Bustos from Illinois, who's kind of a moderate Democrat. She's in the leadership at the lower ranks. Hakeem Jeffries is a New York congressman, African-American. He's somebody who's up there as well. So the problem is it'd be hard to make Hakeem Jeffries Speaker of the House next week. I think that would be a leap. But if they could maneuver it somehow, it'd be smart to have like a Jeffries or a Bustos in the number 2 or 3 jobs. You know, so because being a Speaker of the House is not simple. So, you know, they probably need to figure out there are young voices in that party. It's not clear to how to get them the experience to be Speaker soon, because you basically have to knock out Hoyer, Clyburn, yeah, or Pelosi for that to happen.
And this is what I was saying earlier when I said that she threw younger people bones. So she appointed Bustos, Jeffries, and this guy, I'm going to butcher his last name, David Chichiklin of Rhode Island, to oversee like rebranding of the party post 2016, right? So the idea of like, what did Hillary Clinton do wrong, and let's react to it in Congress. She assigned those people, younger people, that kind of, I guess, sort of high profile.
Can I point out, you do not need to be a member to be Speaker. You could have Beto. You could have Stacey Abrams.
Beto,
these are people who are newly unemployed.
Beto is Nate's.
Thanks to that comment, Nate, you have started like a stupid little Twitter meme where people are like,
"You can be anyone."
It's already
anyone.
Going.
Like Stephen Colbert.
Stacey
it's
Abrams.
Like Supreme Court justice.
Beto O'Rourke.
You don't have to be a lawyer.
Remarkable.
Planting that seed.
Okay, plant that seed, Nate. Claire, let's go back to Pelosi herself. I mean, how is she seizing this moment? Do you think she's sort of savvy enough to navigate this? And do you think, moreover, do you think that she is kind of staying who she is and the party is changing around her, or do you see her actively changing with the party?
I think Nancy Pelosi is kind of like the immovable object here. and I think the party is changing around her, which is not to say, I mean, she's actually an interesting mix in her, if you look at her actual politics, where she is a pretty liberal person. I mean, you know, she didn't vote for the initial war in Iraq. She's obviously represents a pretty liberal San Francisco district. But she is I think she's personally professed that she's personally pro-life. She's Catholic, you know, and an older Catholic. So, you know, she has 5 kids. She's from a certain cultural milieu. So I think her personal politics are interesting, and I don't think that they have changed all that much. And probably one of the reasons why she succeeds behind the scenes as speaker is she kind of navigates those different worlds and sort of is a political pragmatist. She's obviously from a political family. And I would say the way that she's handling this crisis is, again, quite adept. I mean, weaponizing gender, working behind the scenes to cajole members who, you know, say that they're undecided. It's obviously, as we've all agreed, that it's a threat to her speakership. But I think that she is a person who knows very well how to navigate these difficult votes. People go back, when people defend her record, they go back to the vote on healthcare and say, you know, listen, a lot of Democrats who vote, you know, from sort of reddish blue districts lost their seats because of that healthcare vote, and Pelosi got them to vote on it, you know. So I think that there's some interesting stuff to say just about her wiliness.
There were also, during those 2 years where Democrats controlled everything and actually mattered what made it out of the House passed a bunch of other stuff too that died in the Senate. But like, this is why I think there are a bunch of really stupid anti-Pelosi arguments you can make, you know, that she's become a liability for the party politically. I don't think there's much evidence for that. Yes, she's unpopular, but like all party leaders are unpopular because the parties are unpopular. And look, Democrats just won the House and did perfectly. You know, they just had a wave year with her as the quote unquote face of the party. So I'm not sure that argument holds much water. I also think compare Pelosi to like Boehner or Paul Ryan, and I think it's hard not to conclude that she is a much better legislative tactician. You know, she's just better at that stuff than, or at least got better results than they did. You know, the one argument that I think is pretty persuasive is a kind of about just the future of the Democratic Party and that the leadership is relatively old.
And I think she has been pretty unreceptive
slow
to that.
Yeah.
In part because I go back to, she is a person who deals in power, and acknowledging that she is too old or that she needs to appoint people who are younger who would be threatening to her position threatens her hold on power. So I think in that sense, while she is savvy, she has been slow to realize that element in her party, and maybe should have, I don't know, this is hard to like second guess, but maybe she should have. You know, it's hard to replace an older, well-established leader, you know, in your top leadership, but maybe she should have done it, but maybe she felt threatened. So it's kind of this interesting, there are reasons why she has blind spots that have to do with her skill to holding on to power.
So let's wrap up here. And Perry, you know, final thought from you in terms of what comes next. There is this caucus vote on the 28th. And I guess we should mention Trump's very generous offer to provide Republican votes for Pelosi's leadership. I don't know how serious that is. But any final thoughts?
Wouldn't take it too seriously.
Okay.
I guess I think there are two different ways to view this job. One is you're the person who gets bills passed. And how important is that in a Congress where we think that not many bills will pass? I'm not sure. But I think if you wanted to draft someone to get a big bill passed to Congress, I would probably, you know, call Nancy Pelosi first. There's another part of this job, particularly when you're in the minority, which is like which Democrat goes on the Sunday shows or, you know, gives a response to Trump or speaks on television. I don't think Nancy Pelosi is particularly great at that. And I think that's what her critics are saying. I think in some ways we're arguing not just over Pelosi herself, but kind of what should the speaker job look like in a Donald Trump White House, in a social media era, in an era in which, you know, how Beto became those famous culture in the country is because of how you speak matters so much. I think part of it is like Pelosi might be good at legislation, bad at communication, and it's not clear to me which one of those things you should weigh the most right now.
Interesting. Okay, well, we will continue to watch this, and obviously we'll see what happens. But thank you to you, Perry Bacon Jr., as always.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks to you, Nate Silver.
Thanks, guys.
That's two thanks guys in a row. Thanks, Claire Malone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Micah Cohen.
My pleasure.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. We hope you get some time off with your family. I hope you enjoy talking with your family. I don't like all those articles about how everyone's going to fight during Thanksgiving. Some people have a nice time during Thanksgiving.
I get along with my family, and I love them. A lot of people do. I'm very thankful for them.
All right. That's a good note to end on. Thanks again.
Yeah,
thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.